No, 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 no. We're not doing that again. Not this week. That was last week.
Not this week, man!
No, no, no. This is Nuff Said. We're back after Wagner kicked our butts with his Valkyries last week. And needless to say, we are back from death. Well, you know, when the Valkyries come from you, that means you're dead. You know, they're off to carry you away. So, here comes the... the real start of our show. Anyway, this is Nuff Said, and stay tuned for the next hour as we travel through the world of comics. We may even talk about... No, we won't talk about Thor today. We got Faith Hubley, an animator, and we'll be talking about that. And from the Ride of the Valkyries to Nuff Said, yes, we are in comic book Nirvana right now.
And we'll be in animation Nirvana soon.
Anyway.
Faith, are you there?
Yes, I'm there.
Okay, great. Oh, the buttons are working today so far.
So far, not a hitch. We'll start off as usual with the news for today, Monday, February 23rd, 1998. Marvel stuff, haven't had, this came last week, so, didn't have time to tell you about it last week because we were off, but, a decision that surprised few in the investment community, Judge McKelvey gave conditional approval to a Toy Biz reorganization plan for Marvel. The plan calls for Marvel to merge with Toy Biz and for 40% of the new company plus $230 million in cash to be provided to the secure holders of $830 million in Marvel senior debt.
So Ronald Perlman wins pretty much uncategorically now.
While the conditional acceptance of the reorganization plan is viewed by some as the end of the Chapter 11 bankruptcy situation, it actually opens the window of opportunity to purchase Marvel by many potential bidders. This results from the plan of Toy Biz to first offer the merged companies for sale as a package before concluding the deal with secured creditors. While the cost of purchasing the combined companies would be greater, the resulting settlement of litigation between the two over control of the Toy Biz board and the potential release of the Marvel toy license from Toy Biz control make the combination much more attractive package for many potential investors. It's led to renewed speculation.
And that's from Chuck Rosansky?
Yeah.
I think that's a very optimistic view on his part because he wants to buy it. I don't think he'll have his chance to buy it.
So there's renewed speculation that any one of a number of international entertainment conglomerates might present a bid for the combined companies that exceeds the current offers on the table.
Yes, and Ronald Perlman, who is supposedly the fifth richest person in America, who used insider stuff to buy Marvel in the first place, isn't going to let anybody else have it.
And I've heard some of this speculation. It's getting kind of wild out there over who is interested in buying Marvel. Anyway, I won't say more. Anyway, also, Diamond has received formal notification from Hooters that Hallie the Hooters Girl number one has been published and distributed in violation of the company's trademark and proprietary rights. I thought they were doing this with their approval, but this is the line I like best. Hallie the Hooters Girl must not be sold. Please return all unsold copies, full copies, not stripped covers, immediately.
What a choice of words.
I don't know if that was an intended
I suspect pun
or not.
I mean, lawyers don't have senses of humor when they write that stuff.
Also, Top Shelf founder Brett Warnock has brought Chris Staros on as partner in Top Shelf Productions. The new publishing trio of Warnock, Orr, and Staros hope to build in developing Top Shelf's new line of comic series and graphic novels.
And Chris Staros was a guest on Nuff Said many months ago. He's the person who basically reviews the entire independent comics industry. Everybody.
Peter David is leaving Aquaman with issue number 46. For those Peter David fans out there, Nightman, the series, I don't know why it's been renewed for another season. It's so damn bad. But it has. The Spawn animated series begins its second season on May 16th at midnight, with six new episodes ready to air. And reports from Acclaim are that Fabian Nicieza and wife our new parents again. Jessica Louise Nicieza was born on Friday, February 6th. So it's nice to announce a birth rather than a passing. Alex Ross has painted a second Supreme cover for Awesome. For the first Supreme trade paperback, it's going to collect the six issues, number 41 through 46, which is the first story arc of the run written by Alan Moore. And it will be solicited through previews for June shipping. So if you want to catch those Supreme Alan Moore stories, you can catch it all in trade paperback version.
It's just great stuff. So much fun.
And here's some news from the State District Court, United States District Court for the District of Oregon. Claims against Carl Barks, William Grandy, and Kathy Morby individually and doing business as Carl Barks Studios allege the following. They say Barks orally agreed to give them a 1984 Toyota if they'd move to Grants Pass, Oregon from Seattle, Washington sooner than was agreed in a written agreement on February 10th, 1993. Barks also agreed to set aside the sum of $80,000 to be paid in exchange for their early move. They accelerated their moving date and arrived in Grants Pass on or about March 7th, 1993. Barks has failed and refused to give them the automobile and the money. So they're suing for damages of $90,000 or such, depending on what they guess the price of the auto comes
to. Do you have the news about Carl Barks suing them?
No, I don't have the...
Oh, that's interesting how only one side of that got into your sources. Carl Barks is...
Okay, let me read the rest of their allegations, and then we'll hear the other side. Barks also, they say, agreed to pay a 30% commission on the sales of the artwork. Barks failed and refused to pay 30% on three pieces, and instead has paid only 10%. They claim Barks has breached this contract and they've been damaged in the sum of $84,000. They also say he failed and refused to pay them for travel expenses incurred in promotional trips to conventions and such to promote his works. And also in an oral agreement, Barks agreed to create, support, and participate in further projects. They claim he's breached that agreement as well, refusing to provide any further new artworks. And from the other side...
Yeah, I'm not sure the whole story, but this person who was Carl's agent and who most Carl Barks fans feels was not representing Carl very well, was basically making money off of somebody else's talent and not really contributing anything. Something went wrong because Carl Barks is also suing him, so he feels that his agent owes him money. So I don't know exactly what's going on. There's a lot of talk about it on a Carl Barks internet list service.
Right.
Which I am not on.
But and some of this, did come from somebody posting from some of that information up on there. And it included some of their comments. But I didn't want... It was a lot of personal comments and so forth, which I didn't want to go.
And Carl Barks was selling his paintings for thousands of dollars before that guy ever came down the pike.
And, okay. And also in litigations going on in the comic book world, DC says Brainiac Services Incorporated, a small Rhode Island internet provider, is infringing on trademark. Brainiac Services disagrees, saying there's been a whole bunch of Brainiacs over the years, including a rock band. Last month, Brainiac received a letter from a law firm representing DC asking them to give up their Brainiac.com internet address. Lillian Lazerson, general counsel for DC, said, "We're very vigilant about protecting our trademarks," she said. So I don't know.
That could be a precedent-setting court case, because Brainiac, of course, was the name of an actual gigantic computer the government had back in, I think, the 40s.
Which came first, the character or the...
The computer came before the character did.
Well.
But, of course, if DC trademarks, it doesn't matter, right?
Right. The computer, I guess, didn't own a trademark on the name. Anyway, a few more little bits of news here. A new version of the official handbook of the Marvel Universe is in the works. No word on the format. I guess they've got to update all this stuff from time to time. And up in June, a two-issue... Gen 13 Monkey Man and O'Brien miniseries by Art Adams. It'd be good to see him. A Xena Wonder Woman crossover in the works from Tops. And in the Strange Tales title from Marvel, previously thought canceled, Man-Thing and Werewolf by Night will debut in July. The two will share the title starting in May. The Squadron Supreme will get a one-shot this summer. And Shannon Wheeler will have Dark Horse publish his Too Much Coffee Man collection, The Guide for the Perplexed. He's trying to help get into the bookstore market with that, going through Dark Horse, who's had a lot of success in that area. And finally, James Kochalka, who's won the Ignatz Award this summer at the Small Press Expo, has also... been a rock musician as well. I listened to some of the tape, and it was fun stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was like, kind of Ramones and kind of early punk, but very pop and very fun. A lot of fun to listen to. But he's also added another piece of evidence to support his own hype, calling himself James Kochalka Superstar. The College 500 has released the results of their first annual College 500s Awards, voted by radio stations and music labels across the country, and he's been awarded Best Indie Record for his Monkey vs. Robot album. And he's currently working on his third album, the follow-up to that one.
Well, I'm glad that his work is being recognized, but of course, Ignatz winners are one thing, but we have an Oscar winner on the phone with us now.
What is an Ignatz Award?
It's an award given to comics at which convention?
Small Press Expo.
Yeah, the Small Press Expo.
It's for
great name.
It's for independent and self-produced comics, small press items. They just introduced the award this year. So he won two awards that were both introduced, and he was one of the first year's recipients of both.
Lucky fellow.
Yeah. Now, do you do animation or do you do cartoons?
Animation.
Do you look upon it as a difference or is it just a preferred term?
I think there is a difference. The cartoons, you know, come from one tradition, and the kind of animation that that I do comes from, you know, entirely different tradition.
You speaking like a cartoonist commercial and animation isn't, or
No, animation as a whole is divided. I mean, there's that part, that body of work in animation that is cartoon-based, and then there's another that is based more on art tradition. You know, cartoon meaning a design for painting rather than cartoon as... cartoon being funny, clever, and jokey.
Now, you've been in this business for, what, 40-something years?
I'm afraid so.
And how did you get started in it?
I got started in it because I married into it.
Okay.
I married John Hubley. And John Hubley had been in animation, I guess, ever since he left art school.
Oh, yeah, Disney and MGM and...
Not MGM, no. Disney, EPA, and then his own company.
And so he started it when you joined him?
When we got married, he was working on Finian's Rainbow. It was going to be an animated feature, and I was his assistant. And then we went to lunch, and it evaporated. And so we went to Paris, and then we got married, and then we moved to New York and set up our own studio. And so we became independent animators.
Yeah. Now your films have been distributed by a lot of different people. Is it sort of a matter of convenience? Is it choice? Is it opportunity?
Well.
I mean, like, you've got the Guggenheim Museum has done stuff, Yale, the Film Board of Canada.
Well, they're not distributors.
Yeah, well, yeah.
A few of our films, I would say, maybe 10% were commissioned by various people, and the others were self-initiated.
So in other words, you create something, and then you peddle it.
Well, we create it, and we hope somebody else will peddle it.
Okay.
And sometimes they do, and sometimes they don't.
Well, let's go through the process that you use, because it's not the same thing that every animator uses. How do you start?
Start with a storyboard, lots of little pictures on the wall until they are refined, and it's a visual scenario. And then we record...
The storyboard is sort of like a comic book version of what you plan to do.
Yes, well, that's one way of describing it. Another is it's just a series of paintings or drawings in color and a visual representation of, you know, it's done in live action too, by the way, you know. Some directors storyboard their scripts. So that they can see them, you know, they can see the final result before they begin shooting. It seems like a sensible idea.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess doing the soundtrack first is not done by everybody. I think that's something that a few of us do. And then we animate on paper, which everybody does,
right.
But then we render on paper and use materials that are more associated with painting, you know, than cartoons. Cartoon color is limited. The cells have a particular quality, which demands a very even line. And we experimented with wax and resist and, you know, all...
Well, yeah, I found it fascinating that you do about 3/4 of the storyboard and then you show it to the person who's doing the music.
Mm-hmm.
So you work very closely with your composer.
Oh, yes. It's a marriage.
No, when you do that, do you have to refine according to the music? Do you sort of change what you would have done?
Well, it's an adaptation, sure. Because if the music goes first, as I believe it should, the music dictates the tempo, the rhythm, the patterns. Even though, you know, the composer and the animator discuss what is the ideal, but when you get the performance, it's up to the performer. Up to the performer. Otherwise, you know, you end up with something pretty mechanical. And the same goes with, you know, improvised dialogue as opposed to acted out dialogue. If you have actors, if you allow actors to improvise, then you have to be free enough to accept that they improvise, you know, and adapt with the necessary adaptations.
You're listening to Nuff Said on WBAI FM 99.5 in New York.
That's a great title, by the way.
Thank you. Our guest is Faith Hubley, Oscar-winning animator. And the music you're hearing in the background is music that has been in quite a few of her films. It's Benny Carter. And now, a lot of your work is social commentary. Do you think that's the job of the artist in society?
Yes. I think so. You know, and social commentary, you know, is a very broad term, but I think it's better for an artist to be conscious of the world in which the artist lives as opposed to being light conscious.
Well, how much of the job of the artist in society is also to entertain?
Well, are we talking about money or communication?
Both.
Well, if we're talking about money, then clearly the job is to entertain, because that's the way the distribution works. But if we're talking about expression and an art form, then there's an obligation to...
Well, of course, your social commentary is just incredibly entertaining. And that certainly helps get your message across. Do you have to sometimes sacrifice entertainment to get your point across, or do you have to sacrifice some of your point to make it more entertaining so more people will see it?
Well, it depends on your goal. Some people, I guess, then particularly you know, in the last 25 years, because of television, cannot think in any terms other than ratings, you know, how many people tuned in and how many idiot things did we sell. But the advantage being an older person like I am is that I grew up when that wasn't a question at all. And you see, even tough guys like Harry Cohn, I started at Columbia, so I as a messenger. Messengers, like domestic workers, get to hear everything. An old tough Harry Cohn would say, "Well, we got to make money. We got to make money, but we got to have artists, and so we got to do one for the art and nine for the money." But he knew the one for the art was important, and they were perfectly willing not to make money on the one for the art. Otherwise, you know, how does it, you know, how do we even make breaks?
Yeah, do you think people still do that?
No. No, I do not. You know, it's interesting. I had dinner with my friend John Kingmaker tonight instead of the animation department at NYU. And we both teach. I teach at Yale, we teach at NYU. And, you know, we have, it's very interesting with, you know, with young people, because they're really, most of them, think only in terms of, you know, of making money. You know, and sit there saying, well, there's more to life than making money. And if you don't address that when you're young, you know, you have no place to go but down. And then we have to work doubly, doubly hard to get them interested in the medium. And, you know, we're successful with maybe 25%.
Now, I've noticed that you do about one project per year. And most of them are short films. I have also noticed that your features, like Cosmic Eye or Everybody Rides the Carousel, even though they're 72 minutes long, they're both 72 minutes. They're
the only number we know.
Yeah, but they're made up of shorts.
No, Cosmic Eye is made up of shorts.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like a mosaic. I made them one at a time with the idea of making a short to raise money for a feature that doesn't sell toys. It's impossible.
Mm-hmm. How long a time were you working on Cosmic Eye?
Oh, 6-7 years.
7 years, okay.
And Everybody Rides the Carousel is not made up of shorts.
It's segments. I mean, you have the 8 segments and
Both 8 rides.
Yeah.
That's the way our lives are. And the Stars and Men, which is our other feature, is also segments. Well, Fantasia is segments.
Yeah.
It's good for animation. Good for
it. Well, sounds like your line is breaking up.
My line?
Yeah, we're suddenly getting noise on the line.
I'm not doing it.
Yeah.
Is it better now?
Let me call you back.
Okay, sure.
And
I'll hang up.
Yeah, we'll
take a little musical break here.
And we'll try to get you back here.
And in the meantime, yes. Okay, and we'll play this. We'll be back in just a moment when we get Faith Hubley back on the line.
Okay, Faith, do we have you back?
Yes.
Ah, okay. Everything is... Yeah, that's a pretty bitter connection. Also, I want to thank the staff of the Donnell Library. Those of you who are just discovering Faith Hubley's work while you're listening right now, the Donnell Library on 53rd between 5th and 6th has a lot of the work of her and her husband. You have to make arrangements in advance, but it's definitely worth going. They have a lot, and the staff is really, really nice, so and very helpful. It's a great resource, and it's one of the great things about New York City is things like the Donnell.
I couldn't agree with you more. They're wonderful.
What I also found interesting, and I have a lot of friends who have pretty big animation collections. I mean, they've got, the International Animation Festivals, volumes 1 to, whatever they're up to now. They pride themselves in knowing who's done everything well before it gets the public eye, if it ever does. And yet, none of them were that familiar with your work. And then, of course, I called the Donnell Library, and everybody there knew your work. It was amazing. The clerks, the people answering the phone, they all knew your work. I just didn't quite understand that sort of dichotomy of animation buffs, the ones that I know at any rate, not knowing it. Do you think that might be because your film was done in conjunction with Yale University or the Guggenheim or PBS?
Oh, no. No. There just is this schism. I mean, our films are known all over the world by people who are familiar with the overall history. But, in the last 20 years, people are inclined to be familiar with those films that are in the mainstream. And the people who are not in the mainstream have less and less and less of a window, for exhibition. that having to do with the short film not being in the theaters any longer.
That, yeah, that's true.
And
I first saw your work in a theater.
That's right.
One of the Monty Python films when it opened in New York. Your film Cockabooty is what was the sort of the opening to that. And I was just totally charmed. Oh, we're getting that noise again.
Probably unavoidable.
Yeah, okay. Well,
we'll just have to live with it.
Yes, I guess we will.
We can sing along with it.
It's a background score.
Yeah.
But anyway, the two kids in Cockabooty, as well as the two kids in were just absolutely charming. And who are those kids?
Our children.
What do they think of? I mean, now they're all grown up. What do they think of the fact that their childhood has been preserved on film for everybody to see?
Well, one of the things that's terribly funny, you know, we had the show at the Museum of Modern Art, and my children, who were now grown-ups, came with their children.
Uh-huh.
And so their children, who are from like 1.5 to the ones who live in New York, the oldest is 8.
That's pretty much the age range of the kids in Moonbird and Cockabooty.
Yes. Well, what is so funny is the little ones have all memorized the dialogue.
Oh, that's great.
And they act out the scenes. And I know when my...
Do they know it's their parents?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
In the beginning, when they were little, they said, no, that's not my daddy, that's me.
Uh-huh.
So the identity is complete. But my granddaughter, Hillary, has memorized Zucker Candle. I don't know if you've seen it, but that's Robert Maynard Hutchins. And it's, you know, pretty intellectual. It's very funny, but it's mm-hmm. Big words. She's got them. And one of the funniest things she did over the weekend is she would look at me and she would say, Spoof and Z? You know, and I just cracked up. In the beginning, a windy day was a sensitive question for a little while because they talk about sex and they say pretty outrageous things. And when they were teenagers, it kind of embarrassed them for a bit. But now...
Well, you were doing your job as a parent to embarrass your teenage kids.
That's right. Everyone needs somebody to hate. But now it's kind of wonderful. And my grandson, Max, he's talking about making films, and
uh-huh.
And as my granddaughter, it's very,
yeah.
It's kind of wonderful.
We were talking about kids wanting to make money. Where are your kids at on that, or your grandkids?
My kids are all tough independents like their parents. Georgia, is a musician. She and her husband have the band Yellow Tango,
mm-hmm.
And they are staunch independents. They will
lead
to what they believe in. And,
Now, what are your artistic and your writing influences?
I don't know that I have... The writing influences are hard for me to pinpoint because I think visually. And in terms of visual influences, the painters, Miro and Clay and Picasso, I think have been the strongest. And then a lot of my work, which is based on mythology, is, of course, thousands of years of ancient art, rock art.
Yeah.
Cave art. Cave art is the beginning.
When did your interest in world mythologies start? I mean, it's in an awful lot of your films.
Well, it's been lifelong, but... the commitment came when we were making of Men and Demons, or we finished making of Men and Demons, and it opened at the Osaka Expo in Japan, and that was, I believe, 1968.
Yep.
And there was an art museum at the Expo that was organized on the basis of time, so that each room represented a period of time, and you walk through many, 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 many rooms. You really came to the beginning of Western art as we understood. and it just blew me away. And I felt so ignorant and so stupid because there's so much that was unknown to me, and I've kind of spent all those years, intervening years, trying to learn and re-express, because I think it's, well, for me, music has been a very, very important part of my life. And when I was a kid, I was a music cutter in Hollywood, and one of the people I worked for was George Antheil. And George Antheil, who was a great composer, incidentally, he did the score for Ballet Mécanique, which was one of, you know, a very early experimental film. Uh-huh. One could say animation based on Fernand Léger's work. And so it was, you know, a brilliant film. They may be showing it at the Léger show at the moment, I don't know. Anyway, George kept saying, look, artists make films for themselves. Artists make paintings for themselves. I mean, we all pretend to be doing it for people, but you do it for yourself. And, mm-hmm. and most paintings are, you know, self-portraits one way or another. And I make films because I want to learn. It's my way of staying alive and student-y and young. And I can't conceive of making a film that didn't teach me something. And I don't care about money, and I don't make very much money. In fact, often I don't make any money. And
good thing you had that teaching job at Yale.
No, you know, it's very interesting. I love talking about money because it has, you know, like everything, it has so many meanings. I beg for money, you know, that we don't have patrons of the arts the way we have forever.
Right.
If you go back to those early societies, like take the Aboriginal society in Australia, and I've met with artists there. It's just understood that art is a necessary part of everybody's life, and they believe everybody is an artist, and so do I, and that you're supposed to be able to express what one feels as one makes one's little way through one's journey on planet Earth. And so they organize their lives so that they don't have much in the way of material stuff, so that they have plenty of time to dance, to paint, to sing, to praise poem. Uh-huh. And, you know, I think we're living in an insane period because that's not allowed for people. And it's very dangerous. It's very bad for the psyche. And it's not much fun, you know. It's not much fun running around trying to make money. So since we don't have a patronage system, those of us who are trying to live our lives in the traditional way have to beg for money. You know, I write letters. I say, would you give me some money to make my film, please? And money, you know, enough money comes in. And it was better, you know, 10 years ago because we had more distribution. We have very little distribution now.
And of course, Congress is cutting away more money for the arts.
That's right.
So I guess it's getting just more difficult every single year.
Oh, yes. It's not, you know, people have to get angry. And
Your Oscars don't mean anything to them, does it?
No. The funny thing about winning an Oscar is that the pattern, as I've observed, is that you don't work, you know, you don't work for a while. We were still doing some commercial work. And I thought, you know, there's something wrong with this. And because, you know, we're brought up to think, well, you win an Oscar, and then your life has changed, and everything will be wonderful, and you'll live happily ever after because you'll be famous. Mm-hmm. Not so.
Mm-hmm.
Not so. People, first place, think that you're going to, you know, you're too expensive, you're going to charge too much, or you're jealous. Nobody likes a winner, really. Best thing is to get nominated and not win.
So your four nominations that you didn't win are better than the three that you did win?
In terms of the results of
That's really interesting.
It's funny when next to the last Voyage to Next, which is a film I love. It has an improvised track with Dizzy Gillespie and Maureen Stapleton. Dizzy wrote the score, and it's just a neat film. And it's, you know, it's been around for over 20 years, and people still see it and love it, and very gratifying. Well, that year,
and it's a great statement in a very wonderful, succinct way.
Anyway, Chinatown was nominated. I think Chinatown is one of the great 10 American films. And a friend of ours was the producer. And so we were sitting at the bar afterwards as people were walking into the big party, and we were singing, "We are the losers, and we don't care." We were just having a lot of fun. And this lady came up to me and said, "Darling, what's for dinner tonight?" And they said, "I don't know." And she said, "Do you remember what we had last year?" And I said, "No, I wasn't here." And she said, "We had roast lamb, peas and carrots, and mashed potatoes." And then I said, "And what did we have the year before?" And she went back to 1927.
Oh, my goodness.
So much for the significance. Well, I guess the best thing is do good work, enjoy it, and have a good time.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a favorite work of your body of 41 films?
Well, it's interesting. My favorites change. There are a whole bunch of them that I really love, but then depending on my mood, had to, prepare for the MoMA show. We had 43 films. And we had to screen all the prints, so I kept seeing them over and over. On Mondays, I liked this one. On Wednesday, this was my favorite. Et cetera. It's nice to like most of your work, looking backwards. There's not much I'm ashamed of.
All the jazz and the jazz-oriented films, was that the opportunity or preference?
Well, both Johnny and I are jazz junkies. Johnny was a jazz junkie because he's not here. Although he's probably a jazz junkie wherever he is.
Yeah.
And we used to, Hollywood in the 40s, you'd go up to the Boulevard and catch Art Tatum. I mean, it was amazing. And it didn't cost much. I mean, the price of a beer, that is, if you were old enough to drink. You could stand at the bar and hear fabulous music, and went on like that for years. Oscar Peterson and Ray Brown and Herbie Ellis were playing at Hollywood and Vine. I mean, it was amazing.
Well, what was it, Adventures of an Asterisk, 1956, and you have Lionel Hampton playing.
Yeah.
Was he famous yet?
Oh, yes.
Oh, okay, so he was a big name, and then he got in your film.
Now, well, we asked Benny, who was a friend, to ask Lionel Hampton. And apparently Lionel Hampton owed Benny a big favor.
Uh-huh.
And so he had to say yes.
Now, I read on the internet that John was blacklisted during the McCarthy era.
Yeah.
Now, were you blacklisted along with him then?
No. And I don't know. I cannot to this day tell you why. I wasn't. And yeah. I think, because it's interesting historically. Well, first, I was not a person who made a lot of money. I mean, I made good money for what I did, but I was a techie. The techies weren't blacklisted.
Oh.
Or if we were, we didn't notice it. I mean, I didn't notice it. And then I was working in the studios, and I went to the head of production. I said, "Well, I'm very neurotic because I work is what I live for." And they all laughed, and they said, "That's not neurotic. Don't be ridiculous." And I said, "But if I get fired, I'll be destroyed. So could you let me know ahead of time, and then I could quit?" And they, they said, "Stop worrying, it's all right." But that comes under the heading of not playing the game.
Yeah, right.
So when Johnny was blacklisted at UPA, UPA was a real threat to Disney, and it was big money. You thought most of it was about money. Uh-huh. So we moved to New York and set up our studio. Granted, I think there was one show that Johnny couldn't do on CBS. If it didn't interfere with big money, there wasn't a problem. It's very interesting.
That is interesting. It reminds me of The Witch Hunts in Still Another Way.
Only
the rich people seem to be witches, you know. Now, when you and Johnny had your studio, how did you separate your working life from your private
life?
Well,
we didn't. when we got married, our two principal wedding vows was to eat dinner at home, you know, meaning have a family life.
Uh-huh.
Unlike most people in our business who do business at dinner time. And to make one film a year. And we did both. I mean, we did have a real family life. The kids could always come to the studio. And often, you know, when they got big enough, they worked for us.
Mm-hmm.
And they, you know, ate and painted or whatever, and helped out. So work was never, work was demystified. They weren't, you know, like most kids, where do my parents go? What do they do where they go?
Yeah.
And it's wonderful now to see how that's breaking down, you know, and we have Parents' Day, or Children's Day, rather. That would be the nice reverse, wouldn't
it? Take your daughters to work day.
Yeah, and then the kids could take your parents to school, which would be really nice. Come on, Mom, you're coming to school today. Do your homework. Don't forget your lunch.
So you dealt with the working system, and it really didn't interfere.
It didn't. For me, it didn't. Johnny isn't here, so I can't talk to him. But
yeah.
For me, it was pure heaven, because it's what I always believed in, and it's what I, you know, it seemed to me very artificial to have that schism of home is home and work is something you do someplace else.
And now you did the Doonesbury special. I think that was your last Oscar nomination.
That's right.
Now how did you end up being the animators for that?
Gary was at Yale, and Johnny was teaching at Yale, and Gary arranged to meet with Johnny and asked him if he would be interested in doing a series. And Johnny said no, that we didn't do series, and Larry, being a loudmouth, said, no, I don't think you should do one either, Gary. And so he agreed to do just do one as a special. And the specials have been phased out. Isn't that interesting? There are hardly any more specials on television. They only want those big numbers.
Yeah, although the specials were done for big numbers.
Anyway, so Gary is wonderful. Gary is a genius. Unqualified, unmitigated genius.
You're listening to Nuff Said on WBAI FM 99.5 in New York City. Our guest is Faith Hubley. And how about take some listener phone calls? Our number is 212-279-3400. 212-279-3400. You're on the air.
Hi, I'd like to find out, for someone who wants to break into animation with using today's technology, what do you think of the various programs, like Adobe is famous for some beginning animations that they have, After Effects and Premiere, and I was just wondering, have you ever tested any of those, and what's your opinion of them, and also the controversy using the Mac versus the PC for your animations. How do you feel about that?
Well, I'm sorry to say that I'm an old handicraft person, and I don't like the invasion of the computer into my life. So I'm unable to help, and I can't tell you anything because I know nothing.
So you simply just continue to draw each frame?
Oh, yes.
Manually?
Yes, with my hands. I do it with my toes if I had to.
So you haven't had any Scintilla of interest in testing out the new technology?
No, not at all. I think...
If you saw her work, you'd understand. It just doesn't work with computers. It just is. It wouldn't be right.
You know, what they were suggesting that even if you did the original by hand, you could semi duplicate some of the parts that you need, so that she wouldn't have to continuously replicate the same movements manually. You know, could simply do gradations.
What I would suggest to you is get over to the Donnell Library and see about viewing some of John and Faith Hubley's films. Most of them are 10 minutes long or thereabouts. And you'll see that you don't have to use a computer, and in fact, sometimes you shouldn't.
If you want to know about computers, you should talk to the people, like at the NYU film department, they're about half computerized now. UCLA is, USC, all the film schools are teaching computer animation because they're preparing the students. Hello?
Oh, no, he had hung up.
we sent him away.
what do you think when you're viewing... other animators who are working with computers, do you have any reaction?
Yes, I find that, some of it is dazzling the first time. You look at it the second time and it's totally predictable. And to me, what is the magic of animation is its unpredictability. And when the machine does the line over and over and over, perfectly, 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 to me it is utterly boring. It puts me to sleep.
Yeah. Number is 212-279-3400. You're on the air.
You're all a bunch of junk!
You're on the air.
Hello?
Hi.
Hi, Faith?
Yeah?
Hi. When I heard you were on tonight, I ran into the other room and got my copy of Masters of Animation by John Hallis.
Uh-huh.
And I'm looking at two beautiful color stills from Hello and Women of the World.
Yes.
And I was thinking, if I remember correctly, you and John had done some short cartoons for Sesame Street back in the early days?
Yes, he did.
Okay, yeah, the little girl who was trying to persuade her cat to get the saucer of milk.
We did so many, I don't remember.
Wow. I have Moonbird and The Hole that I taped years ago. I've always loved Moonbird. And I was wondering, how can I get your cartoons on tape these days?
Pyramid Media. They're in California. And I believe that the bookstore at the Museum of Modern Art, when we had our retrospective, they had copies in the store.
I have the number for Pyramid Media. They have an 800 number, 800-421-2304.
2304.
Yeah, 1-800-421-2304 as Pyramid Media. And they have, do they have all of your films or just most of them?
Most of them. And then Lightyear has the others. Between Pyramid and Lightyear, the whole library is covered.
There's also a small black and white still from the Ford Motor Company commercial that John did.
It's a
really funny drawing. Do you know if there are any legitimate compilations of commercials? I see at comic book conventions, and sometimes I see in stores they have like bad quality commercial tapes. Do you know if those commercials that he did are available at all?
I really don't know. I don't know of any.
Well, I'll look for them. If I could just read this quote of yours, I think it's great. You said, "I wouldn't do a film I didn't really believe in and love. I've reached the point where if I can't do exactly what I want to do in a film, I'd rather be a bartender."
That is true. And we never know when we'll find me at the bar.
Okay, thanks a lot. I've always loved your work.
Thank you so much. Wonderful talking to you.
Search for it. Take care. Bye.
Thanks for your call.
Well, that's a miracle, isn't it?
What?
To have somebody call up that you don't know and be so sweet.
Oh, it happens all the time on BAI. You're on the air. Of course, then we also get people like that who are 12 and should be in one of your films.
What are they doing up so late?
I wonder why kids who are that young are up so late, but they seem to be. Number 212-279-3400. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
Good evening. Great show. Thank you, Ken.
Yeah, thank you.
Just wanted to say that very interesting about not going to computers, ma'am. I can't believe you're still doing the hand thing. You're able to survive without that, and I'm still there. So I want you to know you're not alone
in
that regard.
We'll be the people who keep the artists from becoming an extinct species, right?
Well, I'm not an artist, but I'm still, and I'm not yet in the computer world. And you didn't scare that caller. I want to clarify, so you should know he's a regular caller. You didn't scare him away. He never says goodbye. He's a very rude, mean person.
Yeah, well, anyway.
Okay.
Okay.
All right, bye.
You're on the air.
Bye. Is that a ghost?
I think maybe it is. I'm wondering when you've done films with your kids in them, and you've done films that make social statements. So you make films that talk about world mythology. Is anyone more sort of satisfying after you're done than the other?
I don't know. I did an autobiographical film called My Universe Inside Out.
Uh-huh.
Which, if you get a chance, look at. And I tried to experiment, using animation in a very concise, I don't even know how to describe it, but, to sort of go through big traumatic or big events with, like, one sentence and 12 drawings. And it was very interesting. It was very interesting. And when it was finished, it won the Columbus Directors Award, so it went on a tour. John Columbus takes a bunch of films, and he goes from one end of the country to the other in his car with his projector.
Uh-huh.
It's quite amazing. And he did a showing in Maplewood, New Jersey, and it was close enough so that I could go because I wanted to see the film with an audience.
Mm.
And because it was so direct, it didn't seem very personal. And when it was over, people started to tell their stories. They didn't,
uh-huh.
they didn't. I've never had quite an experience like that. But we had like 45 minutes of discussion. If it wasn't discussion, it was like people just telling their stories. It was just wonderful. And then I showed it at Sundance. Absolute Vodka had an evening of little 10-second pieces, a bunch of us did.
And they had a web page with a lot of things about you on it.
And then we showed My Universe at the end of this evening. And then there were a bunch of Mormon ladies, and they were all crying. And they said, all of our lives are basically the same. And they were saying, it's so wonderful that someone is telling our story, because I'm an elder, female elder.
Uh-huh.
And it was just wonderful. It was so moving. Anyway, I don't know where that came from, but I just wanted to tell you about
it. That's really great. And we've come to the end of the show.
Well, thank you so much for asking.
Well, I want to thank you for being on. It was a wonderful and much too fast hour. And Ed, do our ending announcements?
Ending announcements. Well, we're gonna go out with playing our cart for next week's show, which we made tonight. We finally made a cart promo. Oh my goodness, it's been a long time since we've had the time to make one. And then it's time for our Paul to come in here and take over these airwaves.
And to send stuff to us, it's Nuff Seg, care of WBAI, 505 8th Avenue, New York, New York, 10018. And our email address is nuffsaid, N-U-F-F-S-A-I-D, at escape.com.
And we'll leave you. And until next week, at midnight, same same BAI time, same BAI channel.
And thanks again, Faith.
Okay, be well.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And next week we're having as our guest, Jeff Krell. And here's the promo, and after that, our Paul. See you next week. When someone says comics translated to other media, Off-Broadway never comes to mind. But on Nuff Said, we're going to change that when we interview Jeff Krell, whose Jason stories are featured in Gay Comics, and now an Off-Broadway musical opening this summer with music by Romanofsky and Phillips, who said Jason is the comic they wish Archie had published. Tune in to Nuff Said Sunday night, March 1st at midnight, and find out how the worlds of comics and the stage can converge, right here on non-commercial WBAI-FM in New York.